This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
You're listening to Raise Your Game on Enterprise. I'm Christine Wong, and today I'm speaking to Krister Angerbuck, who identifies himself as the world's first leadership archaeologist. We'll be covering a few different topics today about kind of leadership and motivation and stuff like that. But thank you very much, Krister, for joining me on air today.
Christine, it's great to be here. You know, we share half of a name, Krister and Christine, so...
Very, very true.
I've been looking forward to the conversation.
Yeah, so. Definitely. So first of all, I think before we kind of get into the topics that you cover, because you cover a multitude of them, you call yourself a leadership archaeologist. So kind of explain what that means first.
So a leadership archaeologist is probably the shortest way to say is a seeker of secrets. I was fortunate to help lead and grow a company 3,000%, a company kind of I adopted as my own at 15 employees. It was struggling, and we, over a period of some time, grew it from 15 employees to hundreds of employees worldwide in 8 countries and 5 continents, a software company doing software for the events industry. And what I realized, there was a moment about 3 years ago that I found myself sitting at the YMCA, which in the U.S. is a kind of a gym. You probably have YMCAs in Malaysia as well, because it's a global organization.
Yeah.
I was signing up for a gym membership, and I broke down crying. And in that moment, this young girl was typing on a computer, and she was filling out the gym membership application, and she asked me a question. She has said, who's your emergency contact? And I realized in that moment that I had no one. I had built this, you know, market-leading company. We had hundreds of employees around me, but I had no one that I could call my emergency contact. And in that moment is the moment that I made a choice to become a leadership archaeologist. And I shifted my focus from kind of trying to be a great leader to what I call inspiring followership, which is a little bit different breed of servant leadership, in the sense that inspiring followership is about what are the behaviors that leaders have to engage in to get people, employees, to want to choose to follow them. And it was a concept that kind of first haunted me, since I didn't have a word for it at the time, but in 2004, I was interviewing an employee, a potential employee that we were looking at hiring from a competitor who was in bankruptcy. And she was crying and telling me about how she was afraid of losing her house, her apartment in Germany, and because the company had missed her paycheck for the third time. And in that moment, I realized, wow, would my employees follow me if I missed 3 paychecks? And I'm not talking about like the ones who can't find a job because they can't get a job anywhere else, but the really good employees who can get job offers by the end of the week, would they follow me? And this is really kind of the difference between kind of being a servant leader and inspiring followership. It's a different bar.
Right.
And so that fundamentally, a leadership archaeologist, I'm looking for all the secrets that I never discovered in all these business books and that I read and business school that I went to. So I find myself in exploring and kind of out of the way places.
Right. Okay. Wow. That's like a more emotional story than I think I was expecting from that title. But also, I think that's a really good point, you know, that kind of difference between being a good leader, but also being able to inspire followership. Because as you mentioned, you know, there's a kind of a more of a sense of loyalty, you know, I think in the latter idea than the former. And yeah, I think that's a great story. Thank you for sharing that with us. So, okay. You actually have an upcoming book, and it's called Leadership Archaeologists, Tools to Unearth Unseen Potential. We'll get to kind of talking a little bit more about the book itself later, but you cover a lot of different topics or different ideas in the book, and also just, you know, in terms of speaking or interviewing or whatnot. So I think we mentioned kind of off-air something about listening, and on the notes that I have here, you mentioned that the secret to listening is talking, and I'm not quite sure what that means, so talk me through that.
Yes, yeah, so So one of the, I think one of the more powerful chapters in the book is about the language of leadership, which is also the language of listening. And so what I realized, I was a terrible listener for most of my career. And frankly, for many years, I was actually a pretty difficult person to work for. And I was a terrible listener. And what I realized, actually after this moment at the YMCA, I realized that the secret to listening is actually in how we speak as leaders, right? So I found as a leader, I was often I didn't want to listen to what people had to say because I was more interested in kind of giving my own ideas. And in giving my own ideas, over time, what I learned is that people kind of shut down and they stopped really necessarily thinking about their own ideas because they always knew that I was probably going to interrupt them and give them mine. And what I found is I had a mentor of mine who said, well, Krister, you just need to lead people to the solution. So as I started asking leading questions and trying to kind of bring people to my own solutions, and what I realized is that asking the right questions is really not about bringing people to my answers or my solutions. It was about bringing them to their solutions. And I realized when I was having conversations with people and I wasn't interested in the responses that I was getting, it wasn't because they didn't have good responses. It was more about the questions that I was asking. So if when we ask questions, we need to ask them in a slightly different way if we want to get answers that are interesting to listen to.
You know, that's something quite interesting. And I think that a lot of that, it's kind of this idea of expectation, I suppose, because if you aren't a very good listener and you want to kind of ask these questions, you're kind of wanting to guide them to your point of view, which is not quite what a question is, I guess, supposed to accomplish. Instead of like an honest answer, you kind of expected them to agree with you or to back up or support your kind of idea in your head and to kind of realize and be aware that, you know, you can't just, I mean, no person thinks the same as another person, right? So to be able to
exactly
guide them to a different and an honest opinion or a different and exciting new idea, the only way that can be accomplished, as you mentioned, is to kind of not try to steer them in your direction and actually be aware of what your question is asking, I suppose.
Yeah. And I think that's, and that's where I come to the language of listening. So, I mean, obviously, like, there's a lot of people talking about listening and, but I was fortunate to learn two languages as an adult. When I was living in Europe, I learned French and German, and I got the opportunity through my career to observe leaders, hundreds of leaders for probably thousands of hours in total, even in many cases speaking languages I didn't even understand. Malaysia is actually one of the few countries I haven't been to. But in any case, what I found by observing those leaders, even in languages that I couldn't understand, it only takes a couple of words. And what I realized is the quickest way to make sure that you're asking questions that yield answers worth listening to is simply to start every single one of your questions with the word what or how. It's nearly impossible to lead someone to the answer that you want or to get a kind of to ask a closed-ended question if you begin the question with the word what or how. So when I talk about the language of leadership and the language of listening, I actually apply a lot of the things that I learned while speaking other languages and really getting down to the very tactical words that we use to listen better and to ask better questions.
Yeah, you know, I think that's an interesting idea of the kind of those two particular, because I guess the other kind of question words, I suppose, is the closest way I can describe them, like where and why and stuff like that, kind of have a bit more of a smaller range of answers that you could provide. But with what and how, it's, you know, what is the idea? Maybe how can we execute it? And you have a more sort of open-ended ability to answer that question.
Yeah. Well, you take it a question like why, at least in North America and the U.S., why is pretty common. I think it's in many cases in business, it's because of the root cause analysis, right? It was in Japan. The guy who worked for Toyota Motor Company said, when you want to get to the root cause of a problem, You ask why five times. So whatever, the production line's not working. Why is the production line not working? The production line not working because blah, blah, blah. And you keep asking why. But what happens is the word why psychologically puts people on defensive, on the defensive. So you can ask the same thing rather than using why questions, which is one of the things that I advise against kind of in the book, is just say, tell me more about this. Or you can say, so tell me more about the production line, you know, not working, or tell me more about the problem with customer XYZ, and follow up with, yeah, the customer is upset because, you know, we failed at the project. Well, you know, I wonder why we failed at the project, or I wonder what's behind that. So often we can really, just by changing our language slightly, we can get more, by people not being on the defensive, we can get more more creative answers. And there's some research in terms of the neuroscience behind that, is that when we go, when people go into kind of defensive mode, they're in kind of a mild state of fear. And when our brains are in a state of fear, the creative portion of our brain starts to shut down. So the likelihood that we're going to come up with creative solutions when we're in a defensive posture is unlikely.
All right. Well, it's time to take a short break, but after the break, I'll continue speaking to Krister all about listening and talking. There's an interesting concept that we'll discuss later of a talking diet. So we'll talk a little bit more about that in a bit. But for now, stay tuned to BFM 89.9.
Beating fickle mindsets. BFM 89.9, The Business Station.
You're listening to Raise Your Game on Enterprise. I'm Christine Wong, and before the break, I was speaking to Krister Unkerbach about why he calls himself a leadership archaeologist, and we also started to talk about one of the topics that he discusses in terms of the language of listening. And you know, we talked about basically how you should really ask questions with what and how, you know, for various reasons. So one thing I noticed on your website, since we're talking about listening and talking, right, you've got this thing called the 10-day talking diet, and I am confused, and I want to know more. So do you know, tell me more about that.
So the 10-day talking diet was born. So as a leadership archaeologist, I go and I do these kind of, you know, out of, once in a lifetime kind of out of the ordinary experiences. And one of those experiences was last year, the day after Thanksgiving, I decided to do a 5-day fast and silent retreat, and what I found, the interesting thing was, the day before was Thanksgiving in the United States, and we go and we have a big meal. I had lunch, and 3 hours later, we were about to have our Thanksgiving dinner. And in this moment, my stomach was rumbling. I was so hungry, yet I had only eaten 3 hours before. Interestingly, over the 5 days following, where I ate absolutely nothing, I drank tea and water and coffee, I was never as hungry as I was in the moments before Thanksgiving dinner, when I had only eaten 3 hours before. So the 10-day talking diet is an experiment for leaders. What I learned is that when we cut everything out and we put strict constraints upon ourselves and how we speak, then we have an opportunity to learn and create new insights in how, you know, we can change our communication for the better. So the 10-day talking diet is a day-by-day set of one experiment each day. One of them is the one I shared in the before the break, of only asking questions with what or how. But there are 9 other experiments that people can go through to start to practice a different way of speaking and then a different way of listening.
Wow, okay. You know, I think that especially for somewhere like Malaysia, it that's really interesting because I don't know how much you know about Malaysia, but we're a multicultural country. So, you know, we have a lot of different languages that we speak. So generally we'll speak English, Malay, Chinese, perhaps even Hindi, Tamil. And it kind of all culminates together into what we kind of very affectionately call Manglish. So kind of Malaysian English, right? And because of that, communication is a bit of a weird enigma for us, because the kind of restrictions we can put on ourselves might be a bit different, I guess, in terms of, you know, how that would work here. So it's interesting to hear, you know, these experiments, because I would be curious to see how that would affect, you know, especially here in Malaysia, where our language isn't quite I guess, typical of the way that people normally use English and language, but I think the concept would remain similar. And, you know, I think also that communication in Malaysia is an interesting thing, and especially when it comes to a business perspective, because I think Malaysia has the highest power distance index in the world, and there's a big issue with the kind of, I guess, emotional and social relationship between leaders and their followers or their team. So, you know, another thing that you talk about is how to kind of learn emotional intelligence. And you discuss this concept of the emotional Einstein. So, you know, what does that mean and why is it important for leaders to be emotionally intelligent?
Yeah, so the again, emotional intelligence was also something that I was terrible at. I was an engineer by training. I started programming at age 12. So most engineers are, as you can imagine, are not the most emotionally intelligent individuals by kind of by natural ability. Yeah, by default. So I had to learn emotional intelligence. And what I found is I've read books about emotional intelligence, you know, 1996 when the first kind of best-selling books came. And I thought I was actually fairly emotionally intelligent, but in fact, I was terrible. But the challenge is that most of the writing on emotional intelligence just tells you what it is. It doesn't tell you how to improve it. And so I found a number of tools in my travels as a leadership archaeologist. One of them, which I think is probably the most interesting, is actually a book that is has been translated into 10 different languages. It's sold over 1 million copies, and yet there's not a single reference to it in the Harvard Business Review. In fact, the books like Good to Great are referenced, I think, 20 times more in Inc. magazine and whatever than this kind of hidden book by a man named Marshall Rosenberg, who is a peace activist. And so I found myself, I thought this book was so powerful that I went to a workshop about it, and I found myself sitting across the workshop table from this man, big muscular man with tattoos, and he's talking about his feelings. Specifically, he's talking about his feelings about being released from maximum security prison for murder. And I'm sitting there thinking, oh my God, what am I doing here? And he said, this communication tool transformed my life. Now, interestingly, what I also learned is that this communication tool is also the same tool that Microsoft CEO Satya Nadella used to transform the culture at Microsoft. And the reason it hasn't caught on in the business world is because the title of the book is called Nonviolent Communication. And at least in English, if a CEO is sitting in first class on a business class on an airplane reading a book that says Nonviolent Communication on the cover, the people sitting next to them will have their eyes kind of like raised and be like, so Bob, like, how's everything at home? What's going on with this nonviolent communication? But what was interesting about this book is it broke down into very concrete language, the language of empathy and the language of emotional intelligence. And so Marshall Rosenberg, this work has been around since the 1960s. It was originally published as a training manual in the 1970s. And he breaks it down to really concrete, essentially fill-in-the-blanks way of connecting emotionally with people in your life, whether it's employees or your spouse or your children. And I found that what he proposes is that we make empathy guesses about what emotions people are feeling, and in doing so, we don't have to necessarily even get them right, because people tend to correct us and say, you know, that's not what I'm feeling. But what happens is if I work with someone over and over again, and I make these empathy guesses, like, so you're feeling this because of that, and they correct me, I start to calibrate. Even as an engineer, I can start to calibrate and get a better sense of building my own kind of emotional intelligence through that process. Mm-hmm. The other thing that I discovered, which I think is really important, a you know, first step for developing emotional intelligence, is actually getting ourselves tested. So you can actually take emotional intelligence assessments and find out where our emotional intelligence is as a baseline so that we can actually know which elements of emotional intelligence that we need to improve.
Wow.
And I think that probably the last point I probably should mention, the most important point about why do we even really want to develop emotional intelligence, especially what you said about Malaysian culture, is that according to the Gallup organization, 70% of employee engagement is due to the variance in the manager's behavior. So if you want engaged employees, and engaged employees get more work done for less money, that's, you know, basically the people who are going to work overtime and not ask for additional pay are the ones who are engaged and excited about the work they're doing. If you want to get more employee engagement, then emotional intelligence is the kind of secret sauce.
Wow, fantastic. I think, you know, the points that, you know, you've brought up today have all had to do with essentially kind of getting on your employees' level and getting to understand them as people and trying to, you know, really communicate and really open up that sort of relationship to being able to, just to get them to know you as a human person, I suppose, mm-hmm. really. I think that really boils down to it. Okay, and unfortunately, we have kind of run out of time, but before we go, if people want to learn more or people want to, you know, see what other kind of topics you cover, where can they go? And also, where can they find your book when it is released into the world?
So the best place for people to go is to go to krister.com, Krister with a K, .com. /book, and that will lead you kind of to the talking diet, as well as some sign up to be notified when the book becomes available on Amazon, and that's probably the quickest way to find me.
All right, fantastic. Thank you so much, Krister, for talking to me today about talking, I guess, and also about listening and empathy as well. But that is about it for Raise Your Game on Enterprise today. If you have missed any of this interview, you can download our app that's available on the Apple App Store or Google Play. You can also head over to our website, which is bfm.my/podcast, where you can listen to and download the podcast. Thanks again, Krister, for speaking to me today.
Thank you, Christine.
All right, you've been listening to Enterprise on BFM 89.9. Stay tuned.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.